In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Riddle me this, riddle me that. Who's afraid of the big black bat?
In an uncertain world, in a chaotic time, justice wears a mask.
Was better.
Love is a game.
What is it about the wrong kind of man?
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
Power is a machine.
Now you've devised a way to read men's minds.
By the way, I've seen your mind, freak.
And revenge is a trap.
You're a genius.
Riddler and Two-Face can make a pretty lethal combination.
Train me. Let me be your partner.
Who's your tailor?
But first, let's meet our contestants.
Going down.
If the bat wants to play, we'll play.
Was that over the top?
Don't work too late.
You forgot the part where you kiss the girl.
The real game begins.
Courage now. Truth always. Batman forever.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, here with my regular co-host, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, as always.
Pleasure to have you here, as always. And we are once again joined by the gentlemen from the Movie Film Podcast, Mr. Zaki Hassan and Mr. Brian Hall. Welcome aboard, guys.
Hey, hi. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you guys. So we are continuing with our journey through Batman, so to speak. And we're up to Batman Forever from, was it 1995, I believe? Or, yes, 1995. And I'm going to tell you, to you guys, you know, one of my favorite things about being a movie fan is when I see a movie and I enjoy it, and then after it's done, I think about it more and more, and I actually find layers to it, and I enjoy it more. But conversely, The worst thing is when I see a movie and I kind of enjoy it, and then as I think about it more and more, I start thinking, why did I like that? And I think that's what we're looking at with Batman Forever, unfortunately.
Okay.
I saw it in the movies when it was first out in 1995, and I thought it was kind of a welcome change from the Burton-esque universe at that time. It had just enough of the surreal feel of Burtonism, if I can create a new word, but it was just different enough that it felt a little bit more lighthearted, and I liked it at the time. I'm not sure I sat and watched it from beginning to end again until when I watched it for the show. And as I did, I had a lot of issues with this movie this time. And I guess, you know, we'll talk about them. We could talk about some pluses and some minuses. Unfortunately, I think I had more minuses now than pluses. But why don't we go through and see, you know, see where you guys are at with it. Start, Sean. What do you have to say?
So similar to you in 95, when I saw it, I thought this was a welcome change from the Burton films. I love the Burton films, so it wasn't a knock on them, but it was time for something different. It's funny watching this now, because I'm a huge Batman fan. I'm a fan of Val Kilmer's Batman, so I'll start off the gate with that. I enjoyed him as Batman quite a bit, particularly as Bruce Wayne. But this tonally felt like two films to me. And I'll talk more about that as we go forward. I didn't feel that the first, you know, back in 95, but I do now. And there's some things that I love about this film, and I'm happy to share them. And there are some things that I really have some problems with because it takes away from the pieces that I loved. But it's a fun film to talk about. I think we're in a little bit of a different place with the film. It's not certainly not my favorite of the Batman movies, but there are elements of it that are, I think, that are really, really good. And we'll talk some more as we go forward.
How about you, Zachy?
Yeah, you know, I remember liking it a lot when it came out. And I would say I like it less now than I did at the time. But I still have a soft spot in my heart for it. And I think this goes to something, you know, I remember at the time, I liked the tonal correction from Burton, which I like both of the Burton movies, but I felt like those probably had gone about as far as they could in that direction. So I welcomed something with a little bit more action, you know, Batman actually turning his head. That was kind of refreshing, you know. And then, you know, 2 years later, Batman and Robin came out, and I saw in Batman Forever the seeds of what I didn't like in Batman and Robin. And so that colored my view of Forever. But in the decades since having revisited it, I'm like, you know, this is just, it's another version of Batman. There's stuff in it that I like. There's stuff I like less. It is, you know, the only time we've gotten Batman and Robin on the big screen other than the movie adaptation of the old TV show. And so for me, it has a little place in my heart just for that. You know, on my shelf, I have the Hot Toys versions of the Kilmer Batman and Chris O'Donnell's Robin. And those toys aren't cheap. So that says something about the place that this film has in my heart a little bit.
Okay. How about you, Brian?
You know, I mean, we've established on the earlier episodes, I'm a huge fan of the Burton films, in particular the 89 Batman. And I think when this movie came out, I have a very distinct memory. I was 15 years old. I remember the opening of this film when the bank vault is being filled with acid and that score, you know, is just booming and everyone's yelling. And I remember, like, as a teenager who liked to listen to punk music, I remember thinking, this is really loud. And it's a very screechy movie. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones, Jim Carrey, they're always yelling. And I never really loved this one. Although I think something that I've come to appreciate as I've gotten older is I do like that each one of the Batman films seems to have a personality, you know. I mean, even the Burton ones, it's like the first one is sort of noirish and whatever, and the second one's kind of more of a Burton wacky kind of film. And then this one is sort of that kind of noir, kind of comic booky, you know, 66 thing. And then, you know, the Batman and Robin is just full on camp and whatnot. So I actually do appreciate that I can get a different flavor depending on which one's on TV. So I do have a little bit of a soft spot for all of them, but I do find that this is probably my third favorite of those four.
Okay, well, I can figure out which one is your fourth favorite of the four pretty easily, I think. And I'm going to leave this open to potential interpretation as we go along, but I've said on numerous occasions that since starting the show, we've added a fifth category. There's Jaws 1 through 4, but then there's also Jaws, I think it's 17, which is 17 or 19, which is taken from Back to the Future 2.
19,
and,
I think.
And that rating is reserved for movies that, yeah, it's bad, but it's so bad it made me laugh and I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to leave open the possibility that I think that about the next one. So we'll see where that falls. But now I'll let you guys decide. Should I go to the things that bothered me more or the things I enjoyed more? Which should we do first?
I'd say enjoyed. I say enjoyed. What okay. Are the things we liked?
Despite the volume, I think the score was pretty decent in this.
Yes.
I was a little surprised, but I think what he did was he kept just enough Danny Elfman in it, you know, just enough of the feel of the Danny Elfman score, but kind of toned it down just a little bit. You know, volume, not necessarily volume wise, but the actual music itself. And I kind of like the score to this. I thought it went along well with the movie. It is bombastic. It does exactly what I say a score shouldn't do, and it calls attention to itself. But I think this movie is almost designed for that. So I kind of liked the score to this movie.
I want to second that. I do think it's to go from this immediately iconic theme that Danny Elfman came up with, I think this is another great theme. I guess my only complaint would be the mix. Honestly, I do feel like you know what it reminded me of? The mix of the whole movie was in the early 2000s when CDs, especially like rock albums, they were being mixed in such a way that it was like overly compressed because they wanted it to feel like wall to wall, you know, sensation or whatever. And then it just ended up sounding overblown and crunchy and whatever. And that's kind of how this felt to me, because I don't mind the music at all. I just think the way that it is blended in with everything else makes it come across screechy. But I love the half Danny Elfman-ness, half like it's like a jazzy nature to it, right? Like the horns and the trills and the things like that, which I kind of like because I think it's fitting for the tone that they're going for. So I do feel like that's done really well.
Hey, anybody else have any thoughts on the score?
I like the theme, you know. I think just to piggyback off of what Brian's saying, I mean, it's not easy to come up with a theme that evokes Batman after really Danny Elfman came up with something that really represents that character for a whole generation. But I think it is sufficiently Batman-y, you know, and it's different enough, you know, and it very much suits the identity of the Schumacher films. You know, it's kind of interesting because back in the day, these films were intended as sequels to the Tim Burton movies, but now you essentially have, well, you have the Burton movies and you have the Schumacher movies. And it's like, well, they have a specific aesthetic and musical identity that I think lets them kind of sit together as their own thing. And you can, it makes it easier to either reject or accept them on that level.
I did feel like this felt like a progression of the same movie series. Like musically, it felt like it was part of that versus being completely divorced and disconnected, which I think was pretty critical. I enjoyed the soundtrack for this one. It was a good soundtrack. I'm with Brian to a certain extent as far as loudness being kind of a thing with this. Well, I think we'll talk more about that when we get into the characters later, because I think my thoughts on the music kind of mirror my thoughts on some of the characters as we get to that point. But I remember this being a soundtrack that I listened to when it came out. I remember this being a soundtrack where there were various tracks of it that I still enjoy to this day as being just solid music. And that's something when you could sit there and go, ah, it was forgettable. I didn't, it definitely had an impact.
Okay. Right. Having given a positive, I'm going to shift over to what I think might be a debatable negative.
Oh,
I did not care. And I'm going to back that up. I've often said, Val Kilmer was one of those people that just always gives a good performance in every movie. And when I rewatched this, I take that back. I didn't think he gave a good performance in this movie. I thought he was too wooden. I thought he was trying to channel Michael Keaton in a way that didn't seem natural coming out of him. I don't know. It felt to me like, you know, one for the money. So I did not care for his performance as Batman. And maybe it might be more that having done the rewatches recently, I'm more enamored with Michael Keaton's performance. And that is kind of letting me down the other road with what Val Kilmer did in this. But I know already, Sean, you said you liked Val Kilmer's performance. So, you know, go ahead, pick away at me.
So I guess I was in the opposite before. Admittedly, when 89 Batman came out, I loved the movie. I loved Michael Keaton as Batman. But when Val Kilmer hit, Val Kilmer was my favorite out of the two. I am with you as the years have gone on. Actually, for me, Michael Keaton, I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know why I didn't appreciate what he was doing there back in the day. But setting him aside now, I think one of the things that really struck me about Val Kilmer on this and why I liked it so much, it's something Zachy said earlier about seeds. I think there were some seeds in this that I wish they'd let germinate in the other film. Because I think the tormented, like, kind of getting an exploration of who Batman was is something I think Batman films haven't done enough over the years. And I thought this was doing something with Val Kilmer that I wanted to see more of. I wanted to see more Bruce Wayne. I wanted to see more Batman. Get to know a little bit more about what drives him. I think we see this also with Chris O'Donnell's character and their interplay together off of this. I liked that there was a heroic moment for the Flying Graysons. I liked Bruce being kind of tormented about the fact that he couldn't save them. Like, he was jumping up, like, ready to say, you know what? Identity doesn't matter here. They're saving lives. I'm responsible for this. They're here because they want me. And to the point of noise, he couldn't, you know, obviously get himself noticed because of that. But I actually really enjoyed kind of the duality of Bruce Wayne being this guy who is going through something major, doesn't sleep well because of the fact that he's tormented by this thing that happened in his childhood. And it's more coming to a head where the dreams are actually becoming part of his daytime. So with the story with Chase, I actually really kind of enjoyed it in this. That doesn't mean you're wrong in feeling the way that you did. It's just, that's one of the things I really liked about this film was Val Kilmer. I liked his portrayal. I liked his Batman.
I am going to say, I'll speak now because I actually find myself right in the middle of what you guys are saying. I really, to Sean's point, I think Bruce is given some interesting things in here that I really appreciated. However, going all the way back to when I first saw this, I always found Kilmer a little vacant or something, or it just, or wooden or whatever Paul was saying. Like, I, not throughout the whole film, but especially in the beginning. And actually when I watched it this morning to prepare for this, and I was thinking, okay, let's watch it for this, because I've always not loved Kilmer in this. And I wanted to sort of pay attention and figure out why. And I actually think part of it could be the abundance of ADR in this movie. I think he might be doing some subtler things, but I noticed there's a lot of dialogue replacement, you know, ADR. And I wonder if it does flatten maybe a little bit of nuance he might've been bringing in his voice otherwise. And so I've always felt like, yeah, he just always felt a little flat to me, unfortunately. But I, again, to Sean's point, I do appreciate that they gave a little bit more psychology to Bruce in this movie.
See, I think, Brian, I think you hit on exactly my issue with it is, Batman and Bruce Wayne as characters, if written correctly, are supposed to be somewhat withdrawn and somewhat protective of their own emotions and thought process. So you're not going to give them the dialogue where they're going to be able to just, you know, exposit how they feel and why they feel that way. So it really does call for a more subtle acting job, you know, and to be doing it with the tone of voice. And you may be right about the ADR there, but also with, you know, with their eyes and with their body movements and things like that. And I'm surprised, frankly, that I think Michael Keaton did that more effectively than Val Kilmer did, because I've always thought Val Kilmer was the superior actor of the two. I don't know if I think that anymore.
Here's where it worked for me. And this may be where we see the film differently, but the distinction for me was everything you're saying about Keaton's is correct. I'm totally spot on with that. I think what I liked about this film is there was this idea of progression of Batman and Bruce Wayne, where he'd been doing this for a while, and now he was getting to a point where, is my motivation for being Batman the same, or can I become something more? Can I actually want to be Bruce Wayne and Batman, as opposed to feeling like I have to be, like I'm driven by this incident that happened? And I thought that exploration was something that this film did uniquely. It was planting some seeds that that's when Zachy was talking before about seeds. I'm like, well, it's part of my problem with this, where this series went, is they were doing something here that was interesting and unique with progression with a character that, to your point, Paul, has been kind of this certain kind of expectation for him. Now they're trying to move him forward. Like, what happens if we try to move him forward? What if we try to move the needle for him? And what does that look like? And I thought they were doing that with this in a way that was something that was a unique exploration we don't get to see with the character. So that part I liked. And now I'm saying everybody has to agree with me, or that even has to be your experience, but it's more sharing, like, why did I like Val? That's why.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, Zachy?
I think that for me, that was the hardest adjustment for me to make, was going from Keaton to Kilmer, because their approaches to the character were so entirely different, that it made it easier for me at the time to just make a separation and say, this is just doing something, you know, the films are just doing, you know, their own thing now. It's not following any kind of a trajectory. That said, I sort of echo what Brian said about feeling like Kilmer's performance kind of got flattened out. Something got lost there, because he had a certain amount of enthusiasm when he signed on, and clearly he was just like a broken man by the time he left it, because he had nothing good to say about his experience. And you're like, this guy was Doc Holliday a year earlier. So, I mean, he has the skills. We know that. But there is something vaguely automaton-esque in some of his emoting or lack thereof, which I would say didn't distract me hugely at the time, because I was just like, well, that's his approach. But definitely now I find it less interesting, and I think less interesting than Keaton. I would say I prefer Kilmer to Clooney, just playing Clooney in the next one, so he still gets to claim that bit, but I think he is unfortunately just one of the lesser Batmen on the big screen, unfortunately.
So now I think anytime you're going to go to Batman and Robin, you're going to have some issues with how you present the relationship between the two, because there's always been the talk of pedophilia and homosexuality, and just I like to put that aside. And what I like to think is that Bruce Wayne is a truly benefactor type person who's taking care of this younger person. And I think by him being, you know, older, you know, by Robin being older, I think, you know, they're eliminating, I think, or at least they're trying to eliminate the pedophilia questions. But it does seem like, well, why does Chris O'Donnell need Bruce Wayne to take care of him? Chris O'Donnell's pretty much an adult. You know, on the other hand, it's if you get by that, you know, all that whole thing is, I think, problematic no matter how they do it. Now, you could have Bruce Wayne adopt or take Robin on, take Dick Grayson on as a ward, with him being, you know, 10 years old or whatever. You know, I think in order to do that correctly, you have to have, you know, give him the proper background and motivation, so that you could see it's a parental type relationship. In this, I think it's more of like a big brother relationship. All that said and all that put aside, I thought Chris O'Donnell in 1995 did this part as well as he could do this part. I did not think he was a negative in this movie. I thought he was positive. I thought he brought energy to the part. You know, some of the things were silly, the karate laundry folding, you know, that stuff. But you know, despite the silliness of it, I thought he showed some emotion. He showed a lot of energy, and I kind of liked him in this movie.
I like that he was his own man, because I think it addresses some of the point that you're saying with the age difference that they were doing with this, where they were doing an older version of him. His initial reaction is, I'm out. Like, it's like he gets there and he's like, hey, guys, this was great. You saved me some time and having to go through a bunch of nonsense I don't want to go through. He already had a game plan of he was going to jump through as many hoops as he needed to be able to just chart off on his own and keep going. I like that we understand Bruce's motivation because of what happened. Like, he feels responsible. So Bruce's motivation is, and also he feels a linkage to, there's a similar occurrence for this guy than what happened to me. But he also feels like this happened because they were out to get Batman. So there's that linkage as well. So I get all of those pieces. I actually liked, though, because of the skewed age, that they were saying, this is a guy who's basically saying, I don't want to be here. But then when he saw the toys and the opportunity to repair the motorcycles and kind of, like, I can stick around for a little bit. Maybe I get a bike. You know, Bruce offered him a bike.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, so there was motivation for him to stay that made sense. And I thought that was good writing for the character. I think he was a good choice for this movie. I liked him. He's one of the pieces that I liked. I got stuff I didn't like, and we're going to get to those. But this one of the pieces I did like was Chris O'Donnell, and that it addressed exactly what you were talking about. It's like, all right, he's older, and they're actually not ignoring it. They're not trying to pretend he's like 10 years younger than he is.
Yeah. I was struggling a little bit with Chris O'Donnell this morning. It's so funny. I like kind of agree with what everybody's saying, but I think Chris O'Donnell does a good job having been cast. Like, he is cast. He did a good job. I just think
it sounds like you're patting him on the head.
No, well, I mean, the movie is kind of like, I just think, unfortunately, he looks like a 28-year-old man. You know, and so his whole thing where, like, the cops are gone, I'm out of here, man, you know, sort of a thing. Like, I can take care of myself. I'm like, yeah, I know you. I hope so. Like, you certainly look like you can. And so I think I almost wish for more like a Tom Holland type, you know, someone who looks like on the verge of 18, where it's like, yeah, you're close. You're close to sort of being your own man, but it might not be such a bad thing to have a helping hand in a time of need. You know, like, that thing might have made, even on paper, like in the script, I like how Robin's written. You know, I just think, unfortunately, I have a hard time buying. Like, I just had Tom Holland in my head, which I know is very obvious, but, you know, discovering the Batmobile and taking it cruising and, you know, being sort of vengeance-minded and wanting, you know, upset about his dad and having this older person who's gone through this very thing who can kind of mentor him a little bit. And I wish he came across visually as a little younger. But that said, I don't fault Chris O'Donnell. I think he's doing a fine job having been cast.
To the point of what you're saying, though, he was 24 at the time. So, I mean, okay. They cast a 24-year-old. So you're thinking about his age, like, that was... I'm more backing up what you're saying in the fact that I was like, just looking there. I'm like, how old was he during this? He was 24. So they cast a 24-year-old, which begs the problem that you're talking about.
But to I think it was Paul's point earlier, I can see where it's like, well, if we get someone who looks a little older, you'll think less about why does he have this boy and, you know, around the house and whatever. And
but I think
if that's on their mind in the 90s, I guess. What's that?
I think you could have gotten around that. I see. I would have liked, you know, we had some flashback scenes in this movie. If you had a flashback, and I think we saw similar in the Nolan verse, where you have Bruce after his parents were killed, with Commissioner Gordon kind of taking him under his wing, and you know where he's broken because his parents were killed. And now if you have Dick Grayson at the same age, whatever it is, 12 years old, and he's in the same situation, and Bruce Wayne sees him there in the police station or whatever after the you know, the murder of his family. And for that reason, he feels the kinship for him, and he feels the responsibility to take care of this kid who went through the same thing that he did. You know, I think you can eliminate the questions of pedophilia and all of that stuff. And I hate even using that word over and over. I really don't want to focus on that. But I think you could have done the story where you did have a young Robin, and maybe you have Batman go out, you know, to fight the villains, and he gets in trouble. And then Robin, you know, without Batman's approval, comes in and rescues him somehow, you know, and that's how they become partners. Like I would have found that more compelling, quite frankly, but I do think what you said, Brian, and the way you described it is right. Once they cast Chris O'Donnell, he did a good job with what they gave him. The problem is more on the casting level than on the performance level.
Right. I'm curious, Zachy, what you feel.
I mean, it's clear. Yeah. Obviously they were trying to dance around the issues that we're bringing up about, you know, Batman fostering a kid, and more so than even the sort of the predatory aspect, there's just the irresponsible aspect of Bruce Wayne, you know, adopting like a 12-year-old and being like, all right, wear, you know, bright yellow and red on the rooftop here with me. You know, it's just it's amazing that there's only one dead Robin in the comics, you know. So they're trying to dance around that. Excuse me. Clearly they were trying to have him be kind of more of a Nightwing than a Robin, which is amusing to me that in the film he's like, what's a good name? Batboy, Nightwing? And he thinks of Nightwing, but he lands on Robin, which I find funny. Like, well, Robin is like a sidekick name, you know. But I think it's just I agree with Brian ultimately. It's like, well, that's who they cast, and he did a good job playing the role as they cast it. But as written, it was clearly written for somebody younger, because you've got, like, you know, when he first shows up at Wayne Manor, Alfred's like, but young master, I made this hamburger for you. I suppose I have to throw this away. You know, he's like, wait, don't throw the burger away. Like, right. Well, we have to get rid of this bouncy house and the clown, you know. It's very weird. So odd choices, but it is kind of like, well, I guess that was the way they decided to go, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're all pretty much in agreement that he did a good job with what he had. You know, it's just a matter of you know, the direction they decided to go. As an aside, you know, I Tim Burton is credited as a producer on this, and my understanding is his actual activity as a producer was that he said, "Oh, you hired Joel Schumacher? Okay," and he left. Like, that's it. Just give me credit and give me some money.
Yep.
So I don't think he really had too much to do with the overall, you know, production of this movie. In fact, I think if I heard correctly, I don't remember where I heard it, but I had heard that he offered his outline for where he wanted to go with the third movie. And they were like, yeah, no, thank you. We don't need that. That's didn't true. Even want to look at it. So, you know, that says how much he had to do with it. Nicole Kidman. I think she might have given the best performance in the movie, frankly. I liked the way she played her part. I thought, you know, she was introspective enough, but also kind of, you know, took things by the horns, so to speak. I kind of liked the way she played it. But, you know, I don't have a lot of in-depth analysis of it. I just liked it. I thought she did good. I thought she was attractive. I could understand why Bruce would be attracted to her. I thought the whole thing was well played as far as she went.
I mentioned the psychology part earlier. I mean, that's clearly why I enjoyed her in the film. That was the part that I enjoyed about the film the most, was the psychological exploration of Bruce Wayne and the duality of Batman. So her viewpoint about Batman and all of that, Those were some of the highlights of the film for me. So she was a key part of what I enjoyed about this film.
Yeah, I was 15 when this came out, and I had a massive crush on Nicole Kidman. On, you know, I'd seen her in things like Far and Away before, but this was where I was like, oh, Nicole Kidman, you know, she's gorgeous. I think she does a really great job with the character they've written for her. Like I was really appreciating the screenplay this morning. I was like preparing for this. I was really listening to it, and I was loving sort of the jazzy back and forth that she was having with Batman and with Bruce, you know, with lines. I'm making this up, but like, you know, like I'm an open book, you know, finally a read I can't put down, you know, like just fun little interplay kind of 60s style flirt stuff. And I was like, oh, this is fun. And she's doing a really good job with it. And absolutely seems like someone that would intrigue Bruce. And I agree with you guys.
Any thoughts on her, Zachy?
She's really horny. It's like, I was like, man, true. I was like,
when
damn,
she's up right there with the bat signal and just shows up in lingerie, basically, or like a
I was like, slow your roll, lady. Let's make it a little bit of a dance here, you know.
Her
job was to make you horny. So,
Well, I was 15, so you know,
didn't take much.
Yeah.
But dude, I love Commissioner Gordon then showing up in his pajamas, like, what the heck is going on up here?
You know, Pat Engel is funny, and I think we talked about him in one of the other two movies. I like Pat Engel. There's something about him that I find very appealing, but I don't think he's Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah,
totally agree.
Yeah, he's not like the ally, Commissioner Gordon.
I mean, Commissioner Gordon from 66 wasn't Commissioner Gordon the way I picture him. Gary Oldman was Commissioner Gordon the way I picture him. Somebody who's actually going to get involved in stopping the crime himself, not just sit back and watch everybody else do it, even though I guess technically that's what a commissioner generally does. But I see that character almost as more of a beat cop more than a commissioner as far as how he's played. But again, I find Pat Engel as an actor to be appealing, so I have not too much problem. But we're going to get to my biggest negative in this movie. And my biggest negative has two heads. It's Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones. And I like both of them. Tommy Lee Jones, I think, is a great actor. Jim Carrey, I think, is a very competent actor who, you know, depending on who's directing him, could do the right thing. They're both trying to be Jack Nicholson, as far as I'm concerned, and they're both doing an awful job of it. I blame the script writers. I blame Joel Schumacher, and I blame the two of them for being willing to do it that way. They're just over the top terrible, as far as I was concerned.
I thought Jim Carrey was trying to out Frank Gorshin. and it was, I'm a huge fan of Batman 66, by the way. I want to be very, very clear off of that. It just didn't belong in this film. Yeah. And I think that's where I started seeing this as being two films. Like the parts that I was liking, which I clearly outlined, so whether you agree or disagree, that's kind of where my head was at. But where it veered off is when we get into the villains, it's like, what are we trying to do here? And that's where you were mentioning Brian Noyes before. So both villains brought to me a different level of noise. Everything was very shouty. Everything was very over the top. Everything was very cartoony. And there was an opportunity with them. You're doing this psychological exploration of Batman that was, I thought, pretty cool for the time. And you have Two-Face, which is probably the greatest opportunity to like do a dual exploration of, you know, multiple faces. And we missed completely the opportunity to do that with this character. Instead, we're going to have him trying to keep up with Jim Carrey's over-the-top Riddler. Right. And I'm like, why? and there's, I'll hit it later. I guess I'll jump to it if it's okay. It's the demise of Two-Face is like one of the things that I hate the most that they feel the need to do in these Batman movies. We go through this battle with Tommy Lee Jones's Two-Face where Bruce is lecturing Dick about how he should not kill him, that you're going to live with that forever and that type of thing. So then he throws a bunch of coins in the air, lets the guy fall. Nobody tries to save him. And we're somehow supposed to be okay with that. I'm like, what tonally are we trying to do with this part of the film? The villains really are, if there's a piece that ruined it for me, and I'm sorry to be diarrhea of the mouth of it, but that's really where this film fell apart for me.
I totally agree. I like the idea of both of those actors as those villains. I just feel like they should have been reined in a little bit, maybe. And, you know, I like Jim Carrey, by the way. I mean, like, I'm of the vintage where it's like Ace Ventura on. I was like, oh, he's my guy. He's my comedy guy. So I like the big stuff that he does and whatever. But in this, it's just there's no modulating it. I mean, even Ace Ventura has high and lows. You know what I mean? Like he can be quiet and he can be loud. And in this one, he is just consistently loud. And Sean, you said something that made me think. I don't know why I never even thought about this. I've just accepted that Tommy Lee Jones's Two-Face is just a loud, screamy character. But man, it would have been so much cooler if he had been brooding.
Mm-hmm.
And then Riddler's really loud, really loud. But then every now and then, Two-Face has outbursts that mm-hmm. scare even the Riddler. Yeah. You know, like that would have been a really, if you're going to pair those guys, why not have the you know, whatever, the dichotomy. So it's, you know, there's things I like about it. There's, you know, riddle me this, riddle me that. There's things I remember and that work, but I just wish there modulation. I guess that's the thing. I wish there had been some modulation to it.
I love that idea of modulation for it.
Yeah, Brian, I mean, this is something when we did our commentary track, that was my big beef, was just like the opportunity was to play up the contrast between Riddler and Two-Face, and you get something interesting there. So if Riddler has this level of energy, then you give, you know, Two-Face this level, and their back and forth would be compelling by way of that. And, you know, for me personally, you know, other than the Joker, Two-Face is my favorite Batman villain. And so this was the first time seeing the character in live action. Such a disappointment, you know, especially because, like, first of all, I thought Tommy Lee Jones was just miscast. I would have loved if Billy Dee Williams got to do it. But mm-hmm. still, he's a good enough actor that given some version of the comic book character to play, he could have done it. And so, but he was clearly told not to do that. He was told not to play that. He was not given that to play. And it's a shame, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you all kind of hit a little bit on the psychological aspect of this movie, you know, where they're exploring Batman's need to put on the costume and go out and do what he's doing. And then you could contrast that if you have a well thought out, intelligent script, you could contrast that with the Riddler's need to throw clues out at everybody, I guess, in an effort to show that he's smarter than everybody else. But this compulsive need he has to give clues, not just to be a Frank Ocean / Jack Nicholson wannabe. And Two-Face, you know, his PTSD causing him to have this reliance on, you know, not making a decision himself. You know, it feels like when, you know, as he's doing things with the coin, he's not letting the coin make the decisions for him mm-hmm. so much as he's putting the coin in the position where it's giving him the decision he wants it to give him. Yeah, exactly. You know, it doesn't feel like the character's truly torn in any way. And that's what I think we need. I think we needed a much greater psychological, you know, scripting in this thing to really give us something. But and then I think maybe that contrasts with what they were trying to do by making it less Burtonesque. I think they were trying to make it more friendly to younger viewers, which, you know, giving it that psychological edge would probably not, you know, would bore the younger viewers, but it certainly would have made for a better movie as far as I'm concerned.
Right. How familiar are you guys with the direct or Schumacher cut, I guess I should call it, that is supposedly out there?
I had somebody send it to me. I have yet to sit through it and watch it. I wanted to watch it before we got to today's talk, but I just didn't have an opportunity.
Yeah, I know it exists, and it's something that Kevin Smith has screened and whatnot, but I'm not familiar with the differences or how different it is. But I know, I feel like Schumacher has said that he wanted to make a more psychological movie, but I don't know if that cut shows that or not.
I don't know if he ever gotten his cut to doing some form of more of at least a little bit more of an origin for Two-Face, but I think that was something that was lacking. Just understanding, like, even the coin. It's kind of like we're left to, I mean, I think if you're a comic fan or a fan of the character at all, we have a greater understanding of the coin and what that whole thing means. But Jim Carrey got much more of a, I mean, there was a live, like, as we were, like, organically following along his origin story as the Riddler. And we didn't give really a whole lot of screen time as far as how did he even wind up that way? And why is the coin, like, an issue? And we're just kind of left with that, which was, it would have been more interesting and compelling. I'd like to see the Schumacher cut just to see what's different tonally, if any.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of like, and I think it's, you know, true to the original comics version of Two-Face, where, you know, he gets the acid thrown on him while he's a district attorney, and he's prosecuting a gangster who actually has the lucky coin that he flips. And again, the PTSD from that trauma makes him, you know, adopt that coin and start relying on it. And I thought that was a cool twist to it. And, you know, again, gives you some sort of psychological questions to play with a little bit as far as the character, a little bit more depth to his psychosis. You know, there's scenes there where he's just sitting there grinning at Jim Carrey that it's actually like almost embarrassing to watch. And again, I like Tommy Lee Jones. I think he's done some great things in his career. You know, one of my all-time favorite things ever was Lonesome Dove, and one of the reasons was his performance in it. So, you know, I have a tough time watching this and thinking, boy, I don't like him in this.
Although it is amazing, though, seeing Hollywood's greatest curmudgeon hamming it up like this, isn't it? It's kind of wild.
Is he more curmudgeon-y than Harrison Ford?
Wow. Now that's a team up I want to see.
You know, the three of us, sorry, Sean.
If only they were in a movie together, right?
Well, I mean in real life, like the grumps, like the old versions of themselves, like they're neighbors and they're arguing over like the, you know, property line and a tree that's on it or something. That's what I want to see.
I'd watch that.
When the three of us talked about The Fugitive, did we talk about them out grumping each other? I don't know. So, is there any other performances in this that are noteworthy?
Gossip Gertie.
I mean, Michael Goh is always good as Alfred. Yeah.
Great Alfred. Was Zachy, were we talking about that? Or I read, was just reading recently, someone being like, there's never been a bad Alfred.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's really true.
Yeah. Which is saying something. That's very different takes, but they've always been potent.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I'm trying to remember a little bit more. I didn't really fall on an opinion of Alfred in the show Gotham. I liked him. I'm sorry, what?
I really liked him, Sean Pertwee.
Right. Okay, because I honestly didn't get a strong enough opinion to say he was, you know, as good as the other ones. But that doesn't mean he wasn't. I mean, I kind of got a kick out of Drew Barrymore and Debbie Mazar as the henchwomen. I just got a kick out of their presence, but, you know, they didn't really do anything for me otherwise.
Yeah, it's a very funny idea, though. I mean, the thing where they're presenting the different dinners, you know, Two-Face. I mean, it's such like a 66 thing. I mean, like the room is literally split in half. The tables are split in half. Like it's fun.
So I guess that's it for the performances. So now, understanding that we didn't get to see the Joel Schumacher cut, and from what I see on Wikipedia, if you are to believe what they say, after some test screenings, they did kind of tear apart the movie a little bit and re-edit it to change it. So his view of what this movie should have been doesn't seem to have ever made it to the screen. But what we get is a movie, again, I can't speak so much to the editing because maybe it would have been different, but I see a lot of performances that I didn't care for. And I got to still put that on Schumacher, no matter how you slice it, because I think he should have seen some of this and said, no, 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 tone that back. Pull that back a little bit. Make that a little more introspective. You know, show that you're seething inside. Do whatever. Mm. But don't give me this hammy crap that you're giving me. So I can't give him a thumbs up on directing this, even though it's not really his vision, so to speak. But I don't know if any of you guys have any different thoughts on that.
I mean, I do appreciate the visuals a lot. It is a very different vision, and it's kind of a bright neon-y sort of thing. I appreciate the shift, I guess. But I would agree that I wish going back to what I said earlier, and I think we all agreed, was the just a little more modulation in the acting. That's unfortunate. Everything is dialed up to 11 performance wise, but I do think the tone of the film is kind of cool and singular.
And I'll give him some credit for, I think the action sequences seem to be well put together.
Yeah.
Well,
they're not bad.
Well choreographed.
Yeah.
So I'll give him that.
Yeah. I mean, he's an interesting director. His movies are all over the map. Yeah. Which is kind of, impressive. I look at that as like a talent, you know. I mean, Lost Boys and Falling Down, Time to Kill, Phone Booth. Like, that's, I love, you almost feel like that's what a lot of directors wish they could do, not be boxed into a certain type, you know, but just get to tell stories. Maybe this week I feel like making a drama, maybe next week I feel like making a comedy. It's, he kind of got to do that, which is pretty cool.
For 95, the technical look of it, you know, with the neon and the technology, and even the bat suits, like kind of moving forward, this idea that there's different bat suits, and Bruce was continuing to experiment with those. Some of that stuff was just really cool ideas that I thought style wise, I actually kind of enjoyed. I thought there's ideas here. And Zachy, I know I keep jumping back to something you said earlier. There were seeds here that, like, I thought, like, could have gone somewhere. And I think some of the wrong seeds, and I don't want to talk too much about the next film. Some of the wrong seeds stuck around instead of some of the ones that I think could have grown out of this film into something more interesting.
All right. Anybody have anything else on this, or should we start getting into our ratings?
Can I say something?
Absolutely.
I don't like the Batmobile.
Well, see, the problem is, I think they made the Batmobile perfect back in 1966. I love that Batmobile, and they were never going to make one that I was going to find more compelling.
I agree. I love the 66 one. I think with my age, 89 for me is like, I gasp when I see it still. I saw it at the Peterson Auto Museum a couple weeks ago, and I still just stare at it. But this one, I was making notes as I was watching it this morning, and I said, Batmobile looks like a toy. And then I was reminded, because it's got like tiger stripes on it. You know, and I'm like, why does it have tiger stripes on it? But wasn't that the whole impetus of getting rid of Tim Burton? Was McDonald's was like, we can't sell toys of Penguin gurgling black goo. You know what I mean? Like, we need Happy Meal toys. And I was like, oh, that's it. That Batmobile to me looks like a Happy Meal toy.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, when you would like want to buy an action figure from, you know, the movie you love, let's say Batman. And so it's like, I want to buy the Keaton one. I want to buy the black suit, you know, the whatever. But then it's like, once you buy that, you know, how are you going to buy more toys? So they invent like, well, here's purple suit Batman and here's Arctic Batman. And it's the same Batman, but he's, you know, got like a gold suit and whatever. They find these like excuses to shake it up. This to me looks like, just, I don't know, some designer came up with another idea to sell a Batmobile-looking car. I don't know, just...
I think it may go beyond the Batmobile. I think there may be marketing things being played through this whole movie that you know, it's never a good thing to have the marketing be more important than the movie itself. So, you know, I think that probably hurt this movie in the long run.
Yeah. They made tweaks to the Batwing, but they were tweaks. It's a design that worked in the couple films, but they didn't veer so far off of it. I actually agree. I liked the Batmobile much better in the 89 Batman movie than this one. I don't know that I hated it in this new one, but the 89 one was certainly something you could have built off of. Zachy, I'm sorry, you're trying to say something too.
No, I agree with that. I mean, a lot of the stuff they changed feels like change for change's sake, because you know, it's like a Transformers season two. Oh, we got a new line of toys we got to sell, so kill off Optimus Prime. You know, that's what this felt like.
Yeah. Totally. And I think it's worth mentioning the soundtrack also. I mean, this was a huge soundtrack with U2 and Kiss from a Rose by Seal. Like, this was, I remember having this CD, and I've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, remembering having this, and Smash It Up, The Offspring, and Flaming Lips. It was, for a Batman film, you know, I feel like they did a pretty good job of figuring out how to integrate some 90s music and make a killer soundtrack.
Yeah, but I'm a cranky old man, so that wasn't my music. But, yeah, you know, I go back and forth. I think I look at it. I remember enjoying it when I saw it. So I have to give it some credit for that. You know, there's a difference, and I'm sure you know, all three of you understand totally. There's a big difference between letting yourself get immersed in the movie and just trying to enjoy it, and looking at it for the cracks and looking for what makes it work when it does work, and what doesn't make it, you know, what makes it fail to work at times. You know, it's, you know, the old expression, you never want to see how they make the sausage. You know, there is something where, you know, we're looking at things with a critical eye takes away some of the fun. It's just, you know, if you're going to immerse yourself in the critical role. But you know what? It's a role, because I love movies, that I've chosen to do. And while when I first viewed this, I think I would have walked out, you know, if I had the scale in front of me, I think I would have said it's a Jaws 2, because it was fun and I enjoyed it, and end of story. But looking at it, I see so many cracks in the foundation, and I see so many things that, you know, and I just can't get over how much I disliked the two villains in this movie. And I mean, disliked in the wrong way. Disliked because I didn't like what I was seeing on the screen, not because, oh, they're hateable. And to me, that's a fatal flaw in this movie. So I almost feel like giving it a Jaws 3 is being generous, but I think it is a Jaws 3.
I agree with that. That was where I landed too.
So, I also landed at Jaws 3, and I struggled with that because I'm a Batman junkie. Admittedly, you can't see it because it's not a video podcast. I got tons of Batman stuff behind me. So it automatically gives me extra credit, the fact that I get to see my favorite character on the big screen. And there were things that I loved in this film, and there were things that I disliked, that it would have been so easy to adjust to make them into things I would have liked. Brian mentioned earlier the casting of Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey. On paper, both could have made those roles work with a different script, a different tone for the characters. Some little adjustments, I think, would have made me feel very differently about both. Because we've seen them in roles, both of them in roles, that I think would have been better suited to, I think, what would have made this film work a lot better than it did. And it's hard for me to say that a Batman film's a Jaws 3 for me, but solidly a Jaws 3.
Yeah, I kind of want to sort of echo what you're saying in that. I mean, I stand by it. If I have to give it a rating here now, Jaws 3. However, I like watching Batman. Mm-hmm. So, like, rating it, yes, this is my feeling about it. However, as something that's fun to put on from time to time, when I've seen Batman 89 too many times, or I've seen, you know, returns too many times. And I was like, oh, I haven't watched this one in a while. They're still fun to be had with it. So that's, I guess, sort of my complicated feelings on it.
Yeah, there's this weird connection where a movie could be more fun to watch, or you might have the desire to watch it more often than a movie that you know for a fact is better than it. Some movies are just watchable as, you know, bubblegum. And, you know, this is one you'd put on in the bubblegum category, I think.
Sure.
You know, you're not putting it on for any deep connection or any glimpse of greatness. But you put it on, and if you're not taking it too seriously, I guess, you can enjoy yourself. It's not a Jaws 4.
Yeah, you get to watch Batman.
Yeah, exactly. So, as always, I want to thank Zachy and Brian for making the time to come on with us, because it's always fun talking to you guys and getting back together. So, thank you for that. And, just to add to that, we are on opposite coasts, and you guys make a real effort to accommodate my time frame. So thank you again for coming on. And anybody who hasn't listened to the Movie Film Podcast, I can't recommend it highly enough for you.
Oh, thank you. And always a pleasure coming on here. It's so much fun.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. And in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Wait. I have a riddle for you. For me.
Really?
Tell me. I see without seeing. To me, darkness is as clear as daylight. What am I?
Please! You're as blind as a bat!
Exactly.